A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad that you can join me today, and apologies for not being with you on Monday. I'll give you the TMI update at the end of the show today, but let's just say up front, things are probably going to be in flux here for the next couple of days here in terms of my ability to ride a Bearing Arms and the ability to do a show. So I am planning on doing another show on Thursday, but we'll probably have to take tomorrow off. And again, if you want to know all the intricate details, just to stick around until the end of the show today, and I'll give you probably more information than you want to know. On the show today, however, we're going to be talking with Pete Frizzelli, former Deputy Assistant Director of the ATF. I wanted to reach out to Pete, to find out what he's hearing from inside the ATF after the election of Donald Trump. But Pete has also been on a pretty interesting adventure of his own, and I wanted to talk with him about that as well. So it's a fascinating conversation about the potential future of the ATF. Is it even going to exist under the Trump administration? Will we get a new ATF director? All these things sort of open questions right now. And that's where we start the conversation with Pete Frizzelli. So take a look and a listen. Pete, it's good to see you again. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Pleasure to be here, Cam. Good to see you.
Absolutely. So I got to ask, man, before we talk about what you've been up to lately, I am curious, you know, we've heard a lot of names from Donald Trump and the incoming administration, cabinet level picks, things of that nature. Haven't heard anything about ATF director. So I'm just curious, what are you hearing from, you know, I have to name names, but I'm just curious, what are you hearing from folks within the agency right now about the election of Donald Trump, about what's going to happen to the agency going forward? What is the mood from the folks that you're talking to?
It's mixed, actually. I mean, some folks are scared. I heard that the inner circle of Steve Dettelbach was devastated when the election results came in. Many of the rank and file in ATF were elated to hear that they're devastated, to be completely honest with you. I've heard that the Trump administration is looking at different candidates. I've heard some attorneys' names mentioned, which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing. Obviously, I've also heard that there are some who want to completely dismantle the organization. You know, I have a different opinion. I think that it serves a legitimate purpose, and I don't know that people want the enforcement of all gun laws to fall in the hands of the FBI or DHS, which are, you know, they have their own baggage, and they're big enough to really put a hurting on the industry if someone came in and decided that that's what they were supposed to do. And I'm not saying that the Trump administration would want to do that. So I don't know. I have been asked by a number of ATF agents who I respect, Jay Dobbins being one. I don't know if you know who Jay is. He's the guy that infiltrated the Hells Angels, to see if, you know, if send my resume up and see what happened. And I'd be lying if I said my resume wasn't in the hands of the transition team. I think I got a snowball chance in hell of getting the nod because I have a lot of opinions and I'm not a yes guy for the DOJ or anybody. But we'll see what happens. I just hope whoever comes in there undoes some of the things that Steve Dettelbach and his team have done. I think that we can go back to the ways of Beto Jones and Tom Brandon, focusing on violent criminals and on helping the industry to work out the warts when they find an inspection where there's someone who's making honest mistakes. I mean, you know, I thought that worked. I thought that was a good place for us to be. I know we had a good partnership with NSSF back in the day. You know, again, I think a small agency with limited resources should be focused on violent crime, not the gun. It's the conduct, not the item, not the industry. It's the conduct of bad people who are hurting others with a legitimate commodity that perhaps they need to be punished for. Because I think, look, people who misuse guns give legitimate gun owners a bad name. That's just my opinion. Just like the Jersey Shore made all Italians look bad. As an Italian American, I was offended by that show.
Well, you know, I think there's an FCC joke in there, but I think he already nominated Brendan Carr to run the FCC. So I can't do anything about the Jersey Shore. But I will say that, you know, if this agency is going to continue to exist, we do need a watchdog in there, not an attack dog, right? And Dettelbach, I think, David Chipman was designed to be the attack dog against the firearms industry. They couldn't get him confirmed. Steve Dettelbach, I think, has been a cross between a lapdog for the Biden administration and an attack dog for the gun control lobby, right? He has not From what I understand, he's not pushed back on a lot of these rules, whether it's expanding who is engaged in the business, that merely offering a single farm for sale doesn't even have to be completed, can turn you into an unlicensed gun dealer, the you know, frame and receiver rule, stabilize and brace rule. As you say, all of those things were going after gun owners, right? They weren't going after the gun traffickers. Now, I'm sure, listen, there are efforts to do that. I'm not saying that those efforts didn't take place, but when you look at those big high profile initiatives that the Biden administration put out over the last 4 years, I mean, Pete, they're all targeting folks who want to comply with the law, right? Who have, they've taken in good faith that the ATF says, yes, you can put a brace on this pistol and it doesn't turn it into a short barreled rifle. Oh, never mind. Yes, you can build your own firearm without having to serialize it. Oh, wait, never mind. Right. All of those vague and fuzzy rules, those weren't aimed at gun traffickers. Those weren't aimed at people who are criminal and misusing firearms. Those were aimed at people who are trying to exercise their Second Amendment rights.
Yes. Yeah. Well, a couple things I'm going to add to that. First off, in my time with ATF, and I left before Dettelbach came in, full disclosure, ATF never had direct contact with the White House. It just didn't happen. I mean, I'm not saying they weren't one-offs, like, hey, can you brief us on something? But to have, like, ongoing contact, it just did not happen. It was when the Biden administration set up the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which didn't do anything to prevent gun violence, by the way, because you still have U.S. attorney's offices that aren't prosecuting armed criminals, right, who are using guns against others. There are a lot of U.S. attorney's offices that have a real hands-off approach, Phoenix still being one of them. In fact, I've heard Phoenix has parked roughly 200 firearms trafficking cases, much like they did back in the days where I wrote that book, where it's like, hey, we'll get to it when we get to it, to include a case that involves over 20 Barrett 50 caliber rifles that have been trafficked to Mexico. So this, that kind of stuff is still going on. And it's not just Phoenix. The Chicago U.S. Attorney's Office was very lackadaisical when it came to prosecuting armed felons using guns to hurt other people. So, I mean, but that interaction with the White House and ATF did not exist until this administration. Rob Wilcox had a direct line of communication with Steve Dettelbach that's been established. So, I mean, that's a problem. What I will say for the comfort of some of your listeners is you heard the name Todd Blanche mentioned as the deputy attorney general, I'm sure. He was Trump's attorney. I know Todd. I worked with Todd when I was an agent in New York, working on violent gangs, working on home invasion crews. Todd sat as a relatively brand new assistant U.S. attorney in the violent crimes unit for the Southern District of New York. He promoted there. He worked with guys that I absolutely respect who went after really, really bad criminals. He's about as measured and as decent a human being as you'll find. And I think that to me, a person like him will keep ATF focused on what they need to focus on if ATF continues to exist as an entity within government. So, I mean, that's something that I took a lot of comfort in. He's not an activist. He is a law and order, go after the worst of the worst kind of guy. He's not the kind of guy that's going to politicize ATF or any other organization, you know, based on my over 20 years of knowledge of the man. He's just an honorable guy. So I was really relieved to hear Todd Blanche's name thrown in for that position. I think it's good for the American taxpayer.
Well, that is good to hear. Because, you know, listen, I mean, I don't know how successful Trump is going to be at reshaping, you know, the federal government, even the executive branch agencies. But as you say, if it's not ATF, some agency is going to enforce federal gun laws, right? The idea that Trump is going to come in and there's not going to be any enforcement of federal gun laws. I just don't see that happening. This is a law and order president, first of all, right? So, again, I'd like that focus to be on violent offenders, not trying to entrap or ensnare, you know, illegal gun owners. But, you know, you and I were talking right before we started recording this. And, you know, you think about it, so if it's not the ATF, then, you know, maybe it's Treasury, maybe it's DOJ, maybe it's FBI, maybe it's DHS. You know, there's the devil you know and the devil you don't, right? And this kind of gets into what you've been up to lately. You know, there are some concerns, I think, about the FBI. Again, talk about a politicized and maybe even a weaponized agency, right? Can you talk about what you recently learned about the FBI and Operation Fast and Furious?
Sure, sure. I took a trip to Tucson recently, drove around Southern Arizona. You know, I felt like a fraud because I wrote that book, The Deadly Path, focused on what I saw, what I physically saw and witnessed leading up to and during Operation Fast and Furious. So I didn't speculate, didn't do any of that stuff, but I dedicated the book to Brian Terry, the Border Patrol agent who was murdered with one of those Fast and Furious weapons. So I decided it thought it would be the right thing to do, to go visit the site where he was killed. So I went there, walked that terrain, which is hostile terrain to begin with. I mean, I'm 59 years old almost. It near smoked me during the middle of the day, you know, in perfect conditions. So, you know, Brian was killed during a nighttime shift, you know, going out there looking for drug bandits. So just to see that, I thought was important. And it was very telling because, I mean, like I said, I had a hard time walking around there. I imagine this poor guy, big muscular guy, gets shot. His team trying to evacuate him before he bled out. It must have been just something. But I got to meet with some law enforcement folks that I had worked with back in the day, you know, catching up on things. And what I learned was, and I wasn't aware of this, I heard rumblings of it, but now I heard it from actual credible sources. As you know, Fast and Furious was a case that targeted straw purchasers. No, and I will not defend that case because you don't let somebody straw purchase over 800 firearms before you allow the U.S. attorney to decide, hey, maybe this person is worth indicting, especially when those guns are being trafficked to cartels, the butchers of other human beings. But what I learned was, and as you know, straw purchasers tend to work for traffickers, right?
Right.
Not always. Sometimes it's somebody who just doesn't want their name tied to a gun for whatever reason. But very often for traffic firearms, they work for traffickers. Well, I learned that the traffickers were two brothers who were actually informants for the Federal Bureau of Investigations, which means there's a possibility that the FBI unwittingly used ATF as some stooge to traffic firearms to Mexico for some reason. But lo and behold, these two brothers were informants for the Federal Bureau of Investigations, and that's who these straw purchasers were buying the firearms for. So what the FBI knew or coordinated, that I can't attest to, but from very reliable sources I heard. And I heard that the Mexican government did not like that these people were used as informants. Apparently Mexico knew. And I heard that DEA also was, you know, initially interested in using these two brothers as informants, but decided that they were so violent and so over the top, just not people that they would want to put in front of a jury, that they walked away and said they would never use them. And as someone who signed off on informant packages as a manager in ATF, we looked at that. Like, is this someone who is detestable, who a jury would never sit there and want to listen to and be able to relate to? And we wouldn't use those people as informants. You know, we know about Whitey Bulger. We know the FBI has a history of using some shady characters. It appears that that might be the case here as well. So here it's like 12 years after Fast and Furious. Here I wrote a whole book about it, and I'm just learning about this development. And like I said, I heard rumblings about it back in the past, but I didn't speculate in the book. I stuck to what I saw, what I witnessed. So a little unnerving to see the Brian Terry, where he fell. And then to hear this, and this was all very, you know, like last week, candidly, while down in Southern Arizona.
That is, and I mean, again, you talk about, look, when you're talking about informants, generally speaking, you are going to talk about individuals who have knowledge that crimes are being committed, right? Otherwise, they have no information to inform on, right? So I think it's fair to say you're not going to be dealing with a bunch of Boy Scouts and choir boys. At the same time, you know, again, you do have to balance that with the idea that, okay, if we're going to bring a case, we may have to put this individual up on the stand. We may have to put this individual in front of a jury, right? And I guess the bigger question is, if the ATF is working on this, you know, straw purchasing case, and the FBI is got these informants who are trafficking guns, was this a matter of the two agencies not talking to one another? Was this a matter of FBI just ignoring this ongoing operation? Because, I mean, again, it seems like there's yet another layer of oversight, another opportunity for somebody beyond whistleblowers like yourself to say, okay, time out. There's something really, I'll use the phrase messed up here, not the word I want to use, but something really messed up going on. Let's lock this down. Let's try to figure out what are we doing here? And it sounds like, again, that was another opportunity that was just completely missed.
Well, look, I can tell you for a fact, ATF and FBI in some parts of the country work very well together. In other parts of the country, they don't work well together at all. You know, there are certain other things that ATF doesn't have a say in. And like, for example, and I'm not saying that I can say that this is the case, but if these informants were national security assets or they were working on something very high level that ATF did not have a need to know about, The FBI is not going to tell ATF. They might not tell the U.S. Attorney's Office. So, I mean, that's again, I'm just hearing this very low level rumbling from people who were in the know. But again, they're not telling me with these who these people exactly were or what exactly the nature of the case was. But let's go back to what you were saying earlier, though, and I agree with you. You know, when you look at the 800-pound gorilla, look at when I was the special agent in charge of ATF's office in Miami, I had to fly to headquarters, somewhat frequently. And every now and then I would get on a plane with Roger Stone. Didn't know the man, never had a conversation with him. Kind of a strange guy, dressed oddly, very gregarious. So, I mean, it was hard not to notice the guy. But he's an old man, right? And you look at what happened when the FBI raided his house. They raided his house with a SWAT team, right? They had apparently people in watercraft be up behind his house. I guess he lives on a property that borders the water. I signed off on ops plans as a special agent in charge, as an assistant special agent in charge, right? I would have never sent a SWAT team to the house of an old man to charge him for the nature of the crime he was charged with. I would have either had his attorney contacted and say, can you have Roger Stone self-surrender? Or I might have even had like a police officer with us to, when he left the house to go to the pharmacy or whatever, pull him over, take him out of the car, arrest him, say, hey, we have a search warrant for your house. We're going to go back, have him give us the key, go in. So, I mean, you look at some of the tactics of the FBI of late, and you look at some of the stuff. And again, I mean, if they were to take over, if ATF was dissolved and be the go-to agency to enforce violations of the Gun Control Act and the National Firearms Act, I don't know that people would be as welcome to this as they are when they just want to say, hey, ATF's bad and ATF needs to go away.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then there's the, to me, Pete, there's still the open question about why Operation Fast and Furious was even allowed to proceed, right? We still don't have any good answers for this. And you talk about this in your book. I mean, all of the concerns, all of the way that this was so out of the ordinary, right? In terms of the concerns that were being raised and what was allowed to happen, I think, again, there's still a lot of folks, including myself, who suspect that, the real purpose behind Operation Fast and Furious was to generate support for gun control laws here north of the border and to say, look, we've got these guns that are being run into the Mexican cartel's hands. We've got to do something about it. Here's all the evidence. And if that was the case, and again, this is supposition on my part, but if that was the case, then, the FBI would not have had a reason to object or would have had every reason perhaps to use these informants as part of these trafficking efforts. Right. Because, again, that just helps build the case, the erroneous case that there's something wrong with our gun laws. And that's what needs to change here in order to improve security in Mexico.
Well, look, as I've said many times on this show, stop begging for more gun laws when you don't enforce the ones that are on the books when it comes to straw purchase, trafficking to Mexico and whatnot. And I think we mentioned this in the past, but if not, I know that Fast and Furious started in Phoenix. It did not come from the White House down. I can tell you it was a lot of ineptness and a lot of just incompetence and inexperience that led to Operation Fast and Furious. I also believe very firmly that once people in D.C. heard what was happening, they saw opportunity. I mean, was it Rahm Emanuel had that saying, never let a good crisis go to waste? Mm-hmm. I know that demand letter 3, right, came directly out of Operation Fast and Furious. I know they were giddy about that. So, yes, to your point, they saw opportunities in that train wreck. In Phoenix, one of the things, and you read the book, I blame is Bill Newell, who was a special agent in charge of the Phoenix Field Division, political climber, very inexperienced. When this was happening, didn't have the wherewithal to say, hey, time out. This is not going to happen. And, there are people like that in ATF right now. In fact, like when a new director comes in, he's going to have to rearrange the deck chairs because you have a lot of inexperience and inexperience can lead to some bad things happen. He may have to throw a few deck chairs over. And I have some ideas on who those deck chairs should be. So if your listener happens to be the next person appointed as the director, feel free to give him my cell phone number. But there were opportunities, I think, that they saw as a result of Fast and Furious to try to implement stronger rules against the gun industry, to implement perhaps new gun laws, demand letter 3 being one thing. But it's disingenuous is I know that before Fast and Furious even happened, The U.S. Attorney's Office, ATF, and NSSF sat down with the gun industry. They put on a Don't Lie for the Other Guy seminar. The U.S. Attorney's Office was there promising, yes, we're going to be, we'll go after these people who are helping traffic firearms to those who shouldn't have them. And they parked those cases and never touched them, as I highlighted in the book. And again, I heard that that's happening again right now. I heard the Phoenix U.S. Attorney's Office is still the worst U.S. Attorney's Office in the country when it comes to going after the people who are fueling this violence in Mexico. And that's just tragic because, again, it gives legitimate gun owners, people who care about firearms, people who care about the firearms industry, it gives them a bad name when you have criminals that are just allowed to run amok untouched when we have the tools to put an end to what they're doing.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Pete, I do, as always, appreciate you joining us on the program. I have no ins with the Trump administration in terms of recommendations for ATF director, but I would love it if there are a couple of good candidates, but I would definitely put you up there on my short list of candidates to be the next ATF director. So keep us apprised, man. I would I hope that we get some good news here in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, look, truth be told, it would be a headache to take the job because my wife would lose her mind. And the confirmation process probably sucks. But I do hope, because I do care about a lot of the people there with the right, you know, mindset that want to really go after violent criminals. I do hope they get a good director. And I hope that director goes in there and candidly cleans house and gets ATF focused on the violent criminal and on working with the industry to work out the problems that need to be worked out rather than bashing them over the head. That doesn't serve the taxpayer well at all. So
absolutely.
Thanks for your time. Good seeing you, brother.
Yeah, you too. People, talk soon. Thanks, man.
Take care.
My thanks to Pete for joining us on the program, and hopefully we'll be able to have him back again very soon. And hopefully we'll get some news about who Trump plans on naming ATF director here in the very near future. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there. Headline from the New York Post. Suspected madman stabber has long criminal history and was released from New York City jail just 1 month before deadly spree. Yeah. According to the Post, 51-year-old Ramon Rivera, identified by sources as the person of interest in this stabbing spree in Manhattan on Monday, has a long criminal history and was released from jail on October 17th on a time-served sentence for what the New York Post describes as a spate of recent burglary and assault convictions after spending most of this year behind bars. The release, according to the New York Post, perplexed Mayor Eric Adams, who said the NYPD, looking into how a career criminal with a history of mental illness could walk free despite his recent convictions. He said, we're still looking over his record, but there is a real question as to why he was on the street. According to the New York Post, records show that Rivera was arrested again the day of his release, October 17th, on a grand larceny charge after prosecutors said he stole a nearly $1,500 acrylic bowl from the Jonathan Adler shop in Tribeca in December of 2013. Manhattan prosecutors had pushed for bail, but a judge ordered him released on non-monetary conditions ahead of a December 4th court date. Sources told the New York Post that Rivera had at least 8 past arrests in New York City, as well as a history of mental health issues and years, they say, of police run-ins, not just in New York, but in several other states. They say that his recent stint behind bars began on February 19th when the NYPD arrested him in connection with a pattern of burglaries in the borough of Manhattan. Burglaries going back to December of 2023. Again, that's when Rivera is also accused of stealing that $1,500 glass bowl, but a thief smashing glass doors, windows of bodegas and smoke shops, stealing thousands of dollars worth of cigarettes, vapes, and lighters. Rivera stayed in custody on Rikers Island for months as prosecutors combined the burglary accounts into a single indictment. He also spent several days at the Bellevue Hospital psych ward back in May, where authorities said he assaulted a corrections officer. And then in August, he pled guilty to burglary. He received a 364-day sentence. The next month, he pleaded guilty to assaulting the corrections officer, earning him a 90-day sentence that was served at the same time as his burglary sentence. And then again, ultimately released after serving 3/4 or 9 months of that year behind bars that he was supposed to be, that he was sentenced to. So, you know, the mayor says all kinds of questions here about why this guy was out on the street. I think we know the answer, don't we? New York, and not just New York City, but New York State has taken this very soft on crime approach, right? And the idea is that it's, I mean, ultimately, it boils down to the idea that they see incarceration as a bad thing. Now, we all should see incarceration as a bad thing, right? But they don't see it as productive. They don't see it as beneficial to the general public, at least in the most extraordinary cases, right? But again, the attitude is, if you've got somebody like Mr. Rivera, who's somebody with a history of mental illness, a history of run-ins with the law, a history of criminal convictions, that prison isn't where he needs to be. And also, apparently, a mental health facility isn't where he needs to be. He needs to be out on the street, according to them. I think the evidence is pretty clear that that is not the case. But until New York starts taking violent crime seriously, until they start treating people like Mr. Rivera as more of a threat to the public than, I don't know, your average law-abiding gun owner, you are going to continue to see situations like this persist, not just in New York City, but across the state. Today's Armed Citizen story from McLeod, Oklahoma, suburb of Oklahoma City, where a suspect arrested and shot after a alleged burglary, shot not by police, but by the victims in this case. Investigators say they got a call about a burglary on Saturday afternoon and learned that multiple items had been taken from somebody's property, including a duffel bag, money, and a firearm. Lieutenant Scott Hawkins with the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office says we've had a string of other burglaries prior to that, so they were in the process of checking out the area. Deputies say the suspect, a guy named Cameron Wapakechi, ran away from the scene. He was found about 4 hours later when family members of the original burglary victim saw him holding that stolen duffel bag. According to an affidavit filed with the Pottawatomie County DA's office, the family members confronted Wapakechi, told him to get on the ground. Lieutenant Hawkins said he had, in fact, a gun, and gunfire ensued. The suspect was shot. Actually, at one point, they said they were wrestling with the suspect on the ground, and more gunshots were fired by the suspect. Shortly thereafter, deputies, as well as the original victim, arrived at the scene. Affidavit says that once deputies got there, the suspect ran about 200 yards and then fell into thick brush. Deputies were able to tackle him, told him to put his hands behind his back. He wouldn't cooperate. According to the affidavit, Wapakechi tried to bite a deputy's hand. In the end, deputies say the crime victim actually helped handcuff Wapakechi. They were able to take him to the hospital before booking him into jail. Sheriff's Office in Pottawatomie County says this is also not Wapakechi's first run-in with the law. Lieutenant Hawkins says he's been in and out of the county jail, numerous burglary offenses, assault and batteries, domestic violence. Not allowed to possess a firearm because of his criminal history, so this is not something new to him. Right now, he is in jail on $50,000 bond. Nobody else was hurt in the incident, including the family members of that victim who, again, fired at Wapakechi in self-defense. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A teenager in Texas who saved a neighbor who got in a really difficult, maybe even a deadly situation. This comes from KJAS.com in the Lone Star State of Texas. Guy, a teenager by the name of Joshua Primrose, saving the life of his neighbor, John Benuelos, during a tractor accident that happened in late September on Benuelos' property. He was working alone on his Oliver tractor, and he became trapped when a steel beam from the loader assembly of the tractor actually pinned him. He said, as soon as I picked it up, it slid back across the axles, and it pinned me up against the radiator and everything. He said the thing's 300 pounds. So he's stuck. He can't get free. He can't get to his phone. He said he was struggling for about a half hour. He said, I couldn't get my feet down to lift because it had picked me up on my tippy toes. So he's yelling for help. Again, he can't reach his phone. And Joshua Primrose is outside working on a vehicle with his dad. And he said, I heard somebody screaming something. So I turned off the music and I listened closely. And I tapped my dad's leg and I said, I hear somebody screaming help. And then we started hearing it more and more. So Primrose got on an ATV, drove towards the sound. He said, I tried to get over far enough where I could hear the yelling. I listened. I heard it again. So I went in the direction where I heard it. And eventually he found Benuelos and worked to free him from that 300-pound beam. Benuelos said, if he hadn't heard me, nobody would have heard me. and I probably wouldn't be here right now. Joshua Primrose is a member of a Boy Scouts Troop 932. He is currently working towards his Eagle Scout rank. And he said he finally got his Eagle Scout project approved, so he should be starting it pretty soon. Even though he is not yet an Eagle Scout, I think that he has definitely shown himself to exemplify all of the good in scouting, as well as just, you know, frankly, simple humanity. In the right place at the right time, will enable to do the right thing to save a man's life. Joshua Primrose, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right. So as I mentioned, the TMI update about what's going on, as you guys probably know, Miss E has been fighting cancer for over 8 years now. Her initial diagnosis in September of 2016. And it has been a challenging few months. Going back to early August, she's been hospitalized. This is now the third time that she's been hospitalized with, not necessarily side effects of the cancer, but, just the effects of the cancer. So she is supposed to undergo a procedure today. And this is where we get into the TMI stuff. She's basically got some fluid in her lungs that is making it very hard to breathe, making it, putting some stress on her heart. So they're going to do a procedure to try to get rid of that fluid. Don't know at this point when she's going to be able to get out of the hospital. So I'm just sort of banking on having to be there tomorrow. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that I can take her home tomorrow and I can be back at work on a full-time basis on Thursday. But that's what's going on. So spent a lot of time at the hospital. She's in good hands and she is feeling a little bit better than she was over the weekend when she was just really struggling to breathe. But if you are the praying kind, I certainly do appreciate your prayers. And if you're not the praying kind, I certainly appreciate the good thoughts. I'll keep you up to date, keep you informed as to what's going on. But that's where I was yesterday. It's probably where I'll be tomorrow. And I am looking forward to being back with you again very, very soon. But in the meantime, be sure to check out BearingArms.com. Tom Knighton is holding down the fort, bringing you the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If I am able to get back on Thursday, we are scheduled to talk with Mike Sedini from Walk the Talk America. Coming up here on the Thanksgiving holidays, that's a tough time, you know. And we want to talk mental health. We want to talk about taking care of yourself and taking care of those around you. So we're going to do that on Thursday. Fingers crossed, I am back. And until we talk again, be well. Be safe. And be free.